owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. It's been said that if you seek peace, you should prepare for war. We know where the conflicts are taking place around the globe right now, but what are the potential flashpoints in the future? Our guest today has got a great new book out, a textbook almost, about what we should look for. He's written and commented extensively on current military affairs. His broadcast media appearances include Fox News, C-SPAN, MSNBC, CNBC, and Nightline. He's also written for the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, and the New York Observer. Colonel Austin Bay authored a book called Embrace the Suck, a complete guide to the language that every civilian interested in the military should know. He's retired from the U.S. Army Reserves. His most recent service was the headquarters of the Multinational Corps in Iraq in 2004. His latest book that we'll be discussing today is called Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. It provides a concise guide to the most dangerous threats to peace facing the United States. Very proud to have him on American Warrior Radio, Colonel Austin Bay. Welcome to American Warrior.
Thanks, Ben. Glad to be with you.
Well, Colonel, I was kind of, you know, we get a lot of requests from publishers to have their authors on American Warrior Radio, and honestly, Colonel, not all of them make the cut, but I received a copy of Cocktails from Hell. I was about 5 minutes into it. I emailed your publisher and said, we got to have this guy on. How quick can he come on? So glad that you could join us here over the long weekend, potentially.
I'm eager to have a discussion with you about why the book's organized and why I chose the conflicts I chose. I think they're instructive. That's the bottom line. I can just say it in one sentence.
Well, instructive is a good word because Cocktails from Hell reads almost like a textbook, and I mean that in a good way. Let's start with, where did the title come from, Colonel?
Well, the cocktails that I'm talking about are mixes of power. Now, you know the term DIME, diplomacy, information, intelligence, military economics, is one way of expressing the so-called elements of national power. But you put them together, and they're notionally a cocktail. They're a mix of power. You don't want to use the military instrument extensively. You don't have to use it a great deal of the time. You can have economic influence, information influence, and diplomacy. And DIME itself is just a simplistic reminder that there's not one way to do something. Now, I frequently get asked, Austin, tell us, could you hear something that's happened several times in the last year? Could you tell me what's going on in Yemen? Could you explain that to me? Well, how much time do we have? Well, one of the things that I'm not going to go overboard on it, but Iran, just take one of the primary actors in the tragedy of Yemen. Iran uses numerous, if you want to call them, gamuts, operations, tactics to forward its strategic goals. Now, you need to understand its strategic goals. I think we got a pretty good grip on that. The Iranian dictatorship meddles almost in every corner of the world because meddling or disturbing or destabilizing keeps their opponents off balance. That's what they believe in Tehran. Yemen is attractive because it's the back door to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is one of Iran's chief antagonists, but this isn't new.
Yeah.
Arabs and Aryans, Iran is Iranistan, have been at odds. If you said 3,000 years, you might be shortening by 500 years, 3,500 years in competition. And there really is an ethnic antagonism, particularly on the part of the Iranians. They just think they're superior to those Arabs that are over there on the other side of the, they prefer to call it the Persian Gulf.
Colonel,
of course, Colonel.
I want to talk about mixes
of power is what we're talking about.
Okay, I want to get into the Iranian discussion here a little bit later in the show. You cover five areas of potential conflict in your book. We're not going to have time to discuss them all, so I like to just, of course, we want to tease people to actually buy the book and read it. We don't want to give it all to them here on American Warrior Radio. But let's start with, to me, the one that was the most obvious. And in your book, you use the phrase maximum pressure cocktails to refer to the Koreas, North and South Korea. Colonel, when I think about, you know, I've heard Gary Sinise has made comments about his visit to the demilitarized zone and what you see there. When I think about the greatest contrast between a country that is free and has a free economy, a booming economy, and a repressive regime, North and South Korea, bang. I mean, that in a microscope, that's the place.
Oh, it's stark. Well, I could have given you a much quicker reply about what a cocktail is. I've got a line in the introduction that says, whether a mixed drink or a geostrategic policy, a cocktail is a combination. So you're talking about combination tactics. List the classic infantry platoon tactics involve firing maneuver, flanking operation, suppression, and the like. And if you look at these elements as their ingredients in a combination to achieve a tactical objective. So to use the term metaphor, an instructive metaphor, that's what a cocktail is. Now, to get to Korea, I've been to Panmunjom. The North Koreans managed to have a bit of a Potemkin village up there, so you can't see the desperation and destruction from the perspective of Panmunjom, but you certainly can from any satellite photo. And the classic one is all the lights that are on in China, Japan, and South Korea, and the very dim bulbs in North Korea. They don't have any energy. They don't have any economy to speak of. It is a desperate Stalinist criminal state run by criminals.
I think that's one thing I found interesting. I mean, anybody who follows military history and current events at all, I mean, we know about North Korea's artillery pieces. We know they have nuclear weapons, and not to mitigate that, but one of the things that really jumped out at me and I found fascinating when you talk about the cocktails of potential conflict when it comes to the Koreas, you talked about the economic success of South Korea and how that may be playing a role in embarrassing Mr. Kim in the North, and discuss a little bit about why this is so dangerous, not just because of the weapons involved, not just because of the proximity of Seoul to the artillery pieces, but the global economic consequences of a war on that peninsula. I mean, that would ripple all around the world, wouldn't it?
Let's start with June 1950. South Korea and North Korea are both on their backs, and North Korea's got a military advantage. But by the end of the 1960s and early 1970s, which side was well on its way to winning the economic and political, let's call them the diplomatic, economic, and even the information war, narrative warfare, or whatever, the propaganda, actually the public affairs side of the conflict between South Korea and North Korea? The answer is slam dunk, South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what emerges in the 1980s and 1990s is South Korea is now an economic powerhouse. It's won the economic dimension of the Korean War. I've got it as the 12th largest GDP on the planet. There's indications that sometime in 2018 it moved up either to 11th or 10th. The statistics are indicative. They're not definitive. But South Korea is a major player on the planet. And North Korea hasn't been embarrassed by South Korea, actually, since the 1980s. And definitely when the Cold War, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and North Korea is exposed as the Stalinist gulag that it is. Its only card, really, then, was military.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something else. This has an economic dimension, but has a military dimension, but it also has something to do with what you can do when you have the money and the technical expertise. South Korea, Japan, and the United States have developed some conventional weapons and also tied to sensor systems, surveillance, some of them drones, some of them satellites, some of them some on the ground, that it has determined where most of those hardened artillery sites are, where the North Koreans hide their artillery pieces that hold Seoul hostage. You have to have the money and the expertise and the desire, the need to develop those weapons, and the threat that North Korea has posed to Seoul with its conventional artillery, both, you know, rocket and tube, has driven the acquisition of these weapons. And it has not eliminated the conventional threat that North Korea presents to northern South Korea.
Colonel,
it has mitigated it. It's mitigated.
Colonel, we've got to take our first commercial break. Folks, we're talking to Colonel Austin Bay, the author of Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're having a discussion about some of the potential flashpoints as we look forward for conflict in the region. Our guest is Colonel Austin Bay. He's got a great new book out, a textbook is what I've been calling it. It's called Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. Colonel Bay, we were talking a little bit about Korea before we took the break. One of the things I found interesting, when you talk about the cocktail of power and the things that can go into those different cocktails around the world, you touched on something that I've believed for a long time, and I think you used the phrase economic extortion. One of the mixes that North Korea puts into their cocktail, look, I'm not a geopolitical expert, you are, but our policies there up to recently seem to be the equivalent of giving an impetulant child candy every time they pitch a fit.
Well, that started to end as the sunshine policy that South Korea had, well, to be fair about it, had experimented with the idea that North Korea will get some economic rewards, see that we are not a threat to them, meaning South Korea and the United States, and they'll moderate. They didn't. Instead, they went for nuclear weapons and threatening to nuke Seoul, Tokyo, Honolulu, and now L.A., Seattle, and the like. Guam, attack Guam. So petulant is a very good word to use, Ben. And it was an extortion scheme. They'd go through all this threat theater and then say, okay, if you just got some aid, we'll be nice again.
Yeah,
In 2010, North Korea sunk a Chonan, which was a South Korean Navy corvette, with a sneak attack, and it kind of changed the public opinion, even among the so-called pacifist left in South Korea. Not that that really is that a larger group, but they are a verbal political presence. It said, wait a minute, we got a real problem with these with the North, a real problem that isn't ending, is accelerating as they their nuclear program approaches the ability to deploy a nuclear warhead on a long range missile, and the South Korean, Japanese, and even regional global support for providing aid to North Korea began to disappear. And what you see really since the Trump administration is an American administration that's willing to devote its diplomatic, political, and economic power to very stiff sanctions on North Korea to further beggar the Kim regime, and at the same time even threaten military attack. Mm-hmm. And then I've got a section in that chapter where I actually talk about the Trump administration's coercive diplomatic cocktail, which it was. It really began in February of 2017. It's still ongoing, but the cumulative event from the 2017, February 2017, through the middle of 2018 was the summit between Kim and Trump in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And there were some things that the North Korean regime did that they had never done before. They said they'd talk about, discuss denuclearization with no requirements other than Kim wanted a face-to-face meeting with President Moon and President Trump. And being adults in the room, Moon and Trump both said, okay, what do we got to lose? Come on. And in both of those meetings, Kim did not come across as somebody on the level with either a player up to being on the same stage as Moon and Trump.
Wow.
And his country's not. And I know the coverage about the way, you know, the anti-Trump coverage, but there were things that helped alter the military and political diplomatic gridlock that has been on the Korean Peninsula since the armistice was signed in 1953.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that this is going to be lead to peace, because you're dealing with a regime that is, when I said it's criminal, they deal in terror, they deal in drugs, they're shock lethality operations, which I cover in the chapter. It's a policy. They're going to use vicious violence to threaten everyone. These shock lethality attacks they've launched against South Korean civilians, military, and infrastructure, and against American personnel.
Now, Colonel,
we know they're bad, but we've also set a situation where you denuclearize, and it's verifiable. You may get to live. Essentially, it sounds like a murder mystery or something, but essentially that's what South Korea, Japan, and the United States said to the Kim regime.
Colonel, let me, that's sort of, it's a very good transition to the next region I want to talk about, because when you talk about Korea, you've got all the big players. You've got the U.S., Russia, Japan. One of the most frightening things to me was, I think it was in 2010 when Japan says, look, our constitution doesn't prohibit us from developing nuclear weapons. And I think that sent a pretty strong message to both China and Korea. But China, let's talk a little bit about them.
It did. And that's a good example of using, they have both information and diplomacy to achieve a security aim, which is, hey, listen up, you two, meaning China and North Korea. We can have a nuclear weapon very quickly, and Irish will work. They didn't need to add that, but it would work.
Yeah. So. Well, sir, I wanted to talk a little bit about China real quick. Short question, but maybe not a short answer as we transition to China. Do you see any scenario where Kim is no longer around, short of war, that would be acceptable to China?
Yes, but here's the one that I think most likely, and I only hint at it in the chapter. You're saying with the Kim regime isn't around, that there's some sort of military dictatorship remaining in Pyongyang.
Mm-hmm.
That has ties to China. But is no longer threatening South Korea with attack. It doesn't have nuclear weapons, and it's no longer threatening to attack the United States and Japan. That is something that China might be willing to live with. It wants a buffer state. It also doesn't want a reunified Korea. Well, it's tough to talk about these ethnic issues. But no one likes the Japanese over there. The Koreans and Chinese don't. But the Chinese don't really like the Koreans, and the Koreans, having been caught forever between the Japanese and the Chinese, don't trust the Chinese. The North Koreans don't really trust the Chinese. So it would be unstable then, but it wouldn't be as it would be more stable than what we have now, and the threat to East Asia and really the Pacific Basin would diminish greatly.
Mm-hmm.
We really didn't get into the economics of that. We got diverted on it, but look at this. U.S. number one, China number two, Japan number three, and South Korea now somewhere between 10 and 12 in the largest economies on the planet. If there were a war there, the entire globe's going into an economic depression.
That's
one of the things that's on the table.
Colonel, we're coming up on our next break, so let me just sort of plant a seed with you, and then we'll take a break. I want to discuss it leading to China when we come back after the bottom of the hour. I was part of a pretty high-level trade mission to Beijing in 1990. Literally, we were there on the first anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. After meeting with what they claimed were private sector businesses, but definitely party officials and some of their leaderships, I remember on the plane coming home thinking, you know what? If they pull off this, what I viewed as a new economic model, if they can pull that off, yikes, watch out. And we've seen that happen over the course of the time now, and I'd like to chat more about China. The Dragon Revised is what you call it in your book there. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Colonel Austin Bay. He's got a great new book out called Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're having an intriguing chat with Colonel Austin Bay. Colonel Bay is a retired Army, served in the United States Army. He's got a great book out, if you want to check it out, called Embrace the Suck. A little bit more lighthearted than what we're talking about today. We're talking about his new book, Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. Colonel, before we took the break, I sort of planted the seed there for you about China. You have titled the chapter in your book, The Dragon Revives. Boy, when you talk about cocktails, China's been, I mean, they've got, what's the drink that's got like eight types of liquor in it? I mean, China's got everything they can in their cocktail, economic, political, cyber. What are they missing? Anything?
Well, I've actually got a line in that chapter where I said that China is an example of enormous success and simultaneously under enormous stress. You mentioned that you were there a year after Tiananmen Square. The Communist Party dictatorship that still runs China has tried to erase Tiananmen from history, any discussion within China, but it hasn't succeeded. Everyone still, almost everyone, still knows about it. And the problems that June 1989, the Tiananmen exposed, have not been eliminated. They know the party leadership knows that the deal it's made with the Chinese people is you're going to be allowed to have the material rewards of wealth, iPhones, laptops, small electric cars, and you'll have plenty to eat. That's one of the, this is a quick side comment, but it's indicative. That's one of the biggest stories over the last 4 years, Ben. China's moved from a developing country that had hunger issues to a country, at least for the most part, not everybody. There's some soft places out west and down in the southwest and like, people are struggling, and there are hungry, poor people, even in some of the wealthier areas. But for the most part, China's feeding itself. That's an immense human success.
You know,
okay, but at the same time, as they get wealthy, no, it doesn't track one on one that you start making demands about political demands for classical liberalization, more freedom, but it's. It's there. It's within China. China, the Communist Party wants people to know how to do things, but it doesn't want to give them the right to do things for themselves.
You know, sir,
so that's stress, and that's why we're going to be looking at China grapple with that over the next 15, 18, 20 years.
Colonel, one of the most enlightening moments in my professional life, particularly when it comes to the idea of you can't always look at things around the globe through the lens of being a member of the, you know, the United States philosophy, if you will. We were, the last night we were there, we were hosted at a dinner in the Great Hall of the People by, I don't know what his rank was, but he's a pretty high-ranking Communist Party official. And the congressman who led our delegation brought up this whole issue of trade and was trying to tie it to the single-child policy. And if you've ever engaged with them, sir, you know they may speak perfect English, but they always use a translator. I think that buys them that extra, you know, couple seconds to form their response. He did something very unusual. He stopped the translator. He spoke to us directly in English, and he says, look, I understand where you're coming from, but you just don't understand the mathematics of this. And he talked about the mathematics of population versus the amount of food they had. And I tell you, it was very enlightening at that time. Keep in mind, we're talking about 1990. Colonel, you really great.
Look what's happened, Ben.
Bingo.
The one-child policy has come back to haunt China because here they are, the world's most populous a country, but they've got an aging population. They've got an imbalance between men and women that has social implications, social disruption. And they're looking at places where they may not have enough workers. And there's already a black market. I mean, this sounds hideous, but it's there in Asian wives from Southeast Asia for Chinese, Han Chinese, ethnic Han Chinese men. There aren't any women. What happened is they aborted more girls than boys.
I tell you, sir, we were in a park and we talked to a couple there, and this subject came up, and the father kind of rolled his eyes and says, our problem is we're raising a nation of brats because, you know, everybody's only got one child and they're sporting them. So let's a great
that's quote. Another, that's another dynamic there. You see, the party leadership thinks it's carved out a perfect policy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, because they're a dictatorship, it's not perfect.
Yeah. Sir, you
the policy is perfect, but the point is it has come back to haunt them.
Sir, you had a great quote in your book, and I'm going to read it for the listeners. Expanding influence is one thing, territorial expansion another. People may accept influence if the influencer pays in hard currency. However, people fight and die over territory.
That has always been true.
What other adventures? And it's interesting. I see two countries pop up very often, no matter what region we're looking at in your book: Iran and China. Whether it's proxy combat or what we see going on in Africa as far as scrambling over the minerals there, sir. Real quick. Touch a little bit on the proxy combat, Iran, Yemen, and now particularly with what's happening in Syria, that's got to be raising some eyebrows in Iran as well.
Right, but using proxies, in other words, somebody else to fight your fight, isn't new. Backing forces in a complex civil war or regional war and outside power doing it isn't new. Iran right now uses that as a major policy tool. It's not new for them. Lebanese Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has significant sway within Lebanon, is really a proxy Iranian army for struggling, attacking Israel as well as dominating that part of the Levant. Iran has other proxy forces in Syria now, but in Yemen, it's primarily factions within the Houthi movement. But understand, here when you start breaking this down, Ben, it just gets so dismal. Yemen is a nest of wars, and Iran tries to exacerbate 80% of them in some shape, form, or fashion, just so that they aren't solved. And Saudi Arabia United Arab Emirates, and other Egypt, and other nations in the region have to respond to it and react to it. They keep the pot boiling, so to speak. And yet, they use the provide them with weapons, provide them with money, training. In the case of the Houthis, even short-range ballistic missiles that allegedly the Houthis fire at Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabian aircraft are operating supporting Saudi coalition forces in Yemen. But there's evidence out there, and I'm relying on really some pretty good open sources in the defense-oriented, military-oriented media. But it's Iranian special operations troops and technicians who are actually overseeing the launch of these short-range ballistic missiles.
Sure.
The Saudis have been shooting them down with Patriot PAC-3s, which sure. they operate and we operate as well, and they've learned a great deal about intercepting medium-short-range missiles. Been very successful with it. I just point that out is that there was a response to what was to be an Iranian terror attack.
Mm-hmm. Colonel, let me try and tie two things together here, and you're the expert, so I've got no problem being smacked down and corrected. I almost get the sense, you know, Iran, not exactly, I mean, the planes that they can get up in the air, you know, are held together with duct tape and baling wire. They don't really have a, relative to some of the other players we're talking about, don't really have a real potent military. Do you sense, sir, that part of their... what they're really trying to do to develop nuclear weapons is not only to use them as an offensive weapon, but have they seen the success of the economic extortion that North Korea is able to pull off? And they're looking, because I think you said in your book or one of the articles you wrote, the poverty rate in Iran has doubled in the last year. Economics.
Well, that was in an article. And some of the statements like that, yeah, they're, you'll see them in the book, but the book's going to have a much longer life than the articles. It's not just your measurement of poverty, and then there are different ways to measure poverty in a place. But the Iranian middle class, and even the upper middle class, has lost a great deal of wealth because of the devaluation of the currency and really the corruption within Iran, which is immense. By the way, corruption plagues communist China, too.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about two inherently corrupt systems. The Iranians, this is something that I do get at in the chapter. The Iranians really have a bit of a megalomaniacal belief that they should be a global power. And some of that stems from the Ayatollah Khomeini saying that he was, launching a global Islamic revolution. But there's been a notion among the Iranians since the old Persian Empire, before Alexander the Great tore it up, that we are the center of the world, or at least we should be the dominant power in the Middle East. And I think the nuclear quest, yes, there is the regime security component, there's the extortion component, but they wanted to be able to use it against the Iraqis and the Arabs. That was the other thing. They weren't planning on using it against the Pakistanis. They were looking west to their traditional enemies. So, as well as threatening Israel with them, but that's the Iranians know they're weak. They thought over time that with the oil they had and with some of the things that they were doing, that they might be able to become more powerful. And that's one of the unfortunate things about some of the sanctions relief they got.
Sir, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about one other area, the Congo, something that most of us don't hear about and don't pay attention to. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Colonel Austin Bay. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. My producer got me bobbing my head to that intro music. Sorry about that. I'll get it right, Tom. We're joined by Colonel Austin Bay. Colonel Bay writes and comments extensively on the situation, military situations around the globe. He's got a great book out called Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. He really addresses five major regions in the world. We're not going to get to them all because, frankly, we just don't have the time. And number two, buy the book. Read it. This is how he makes his money. So, Colonel Bay, coming back to you, one of the segments that really did jump out at me, mostly because it breaks my heart. Americans have a tendency to not pay as much attention to what happens outside our borders as they should. And you have a full chapter that talks about the Congo and sub-Saharan Africa and just the heartbreaking amount of conflict that has been going on there forever. And that chapter really, sir, I mean, war is a scary thing to begin with, but that chapter really broke my heart.
Well, look, it breaks my heart knowing what has happened in Congo since really the early 1990s. And let just to provide some context and background, that Great Congo War, which notionally erupts in 1996 and extends through 2003. Somewhere between 3 and 5 million people were killed. I tend to think the 5 million death toll is higher, but the three is, even if it's just three, that exceeds Pol Pot's genocide in Cambodia. Now, a couple of other things about it, killing still isn't over. UN went in force in 2003. There was a UN force already, peacekeeping force in. And this is radical in some venues. That peacekeeping force, which was said to have failed in 2008 and said to have failed in 2018, the situation is somewhat better. It's been a huge, huge effort on the part of the United Nations keeping on active duty there, between 16,000 and 20,000 troops. There's still around 17,000 there now. There were even military actions, offensive military actions authorized by the Security Council against some of these rogue militias. What? Now, I've come back to 2003, supposedly the Great Congo War ended, and then Congo gets a constitution and based on the peace agreement. 2018, earlier this year, because we're recording this in December of 2018, I want to say it was the end of March or early April, I really finished the next to last draft, and I looked through the resources, references. In 26 of Congo's, in 10 of Congo's 26 provinces, there were wars going on then. Might have been 12, but I could definitely say 10 of them. Congo is about the size of Western Europe. And I mean, running Austria, Germany, you know, west to France and Spain and at least in terms of area. Think about what the mainstream media would be reporting if 40% of Western Europe was afflicted by anarchic war. Well, of course it's not. Part of it is that it's even in the digital age, it's hard to get information out of remote places within Congo. But in no way, though, dismisses the local tragedy and the human suffering. Now, why I put Congo in there is, first of all, there's that message. A lot of places that you think don't matter, well, maybe they do if you care about other human beings and human suffering. And this is a picture. Maybe the worst in some ways, though you can make some arguments right now about Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, but and Central African Republic, which is just north of Congo, and a lot of what goes on in the CAR, Central African Republic, has spilled from Congo. It was. Is that this is the way a lot of the world has to live, in very tenuous security circumstances. Even though you can go around the Congo and there are places where there is peace, Mm-hmm. You know, there were 16 provinces where I didn't say that it was qualified as a war. Of course, there's violence, threat, theft, and crime, but, you know, not shooting and armed militias and calling war parties killing one another. But here's the second one, and it's the global significance. Congo sits on one of the richest mineral deposits in the entire world. Cobalt, just among them. Coltan, copper, uranium. The bombs, the uranium for the two American nuclear devices that we detonated in Japan in World War II came from the Katanga province in Congo. It's extremely, several of the mineral deposits are extremely rich. And cobalt, I mean, in terms of the ore. China is right now buying between 80 and 90% of Congo's cobalt production. Why? China is into the batteries for electric vehicles in a major way. They're building these small urban cars, they call them, electric powered, so that to make their, help their people feel rich, wealthy, and happy, they can tour around Shanghai and Beijing in these little electric cars. It takes 10 kilos, about 22 pounds of Congolese cobalt to make the current type of batteries they have for those and some other similar electric vehicles.
Kurt.
Therefore, China is now the imperial power of note in Katanga province in Congo, and a huge investment in there. And when you have an outside power like that, you mention expanding power. China's expanding into the South China Sea with the artificial islands. Everybody almost, if not in my book, forgets that China and India are still at war over certain parts of the Himalayas. 1962 Sino-Indian War. If people have forgotten about that, India and China have. So China's this expanding global military power, economic dynamo, is very active in Congo.
Colonel, we've got just about 3 minutes left. There's something I want to touch on. It's really more of a question for you, sir. I didn't see any mention of any Latin American hot spots. You know, Venezuela is kind of a bubbling cauldron now and sort of stepping out of the traditional military context as well. To what extent can the drug war potentially bubble over into a real tanks,
you ask a very good question, because if there had been a sixth war, it was going to be Mexico's cartel war.
Okay.
And it was because there is some level in there. In the first chapter, the intro and first chapter, I get into what's the gradation between criminal action, gang warfare in Los Angeles, and militia warfare in Bangui, Central African Republic. If you're a cop or a peacekeeper who's caught between it, there's very little if they were armed with AK-47s and aren't even semi-automatic weapons. But at times, the intensity of the violence at the height of Mexico's cartel war certainly rivaled the intensity of guerrilla conflicts that were outside wars. People tossed around descriptions like, you know, criminal warfare or, okay, came close to it. There were political differences, or let's say economic differences. These were gangs. They were interested in wealth. They were really not interested in political power. They just wanted to buy politicians so they had the space to be successful organized crime operations. But that was something that, because that is a dimension in many of these places. So you can certainly see it in parts of the Southeast Asia, certainly see it in places in the Middle East, in Africa, and it's not confined to, of course, Mexico and the Americas. That dimension is often hidden. Iran, though, makes use of criminal operations, and so has North Korea. And I don't mean as intelligence sources, but I mean as disruptive policy sources. They're part of their cocktail mix for meddling with their enemies. So how would that have been? That's a great question, Ben. We decided that this was the length we wanted out of it. I really covered And as you mentioned, in depth, the five case studies. And remember, I'm not being predictive about what's going to happen. I show you some alternatives. I discuss goals of the participants, and I also talk about some of their strategic cocktails as well as operational cocktails.
Well, Colonel,
those can change.
Colonel, it's been such a joy having you here on American Warrior Radio. I encourage folks, again, get the book, Cocktails from Hell, Five Complex Wars Shaping the 21st Century. Colonel, thank you so much for your time today. What's your website, sir? Where can people find out more?
All right. Let me give you two to follow it on. First of all, I've written for now almost 20 years a weekly syndicated newspaper column with Creator Syndicate out of Los Angeles. But StrategyPage.com and AustinBug.net. Those are the two.
Perfect. Thank you, sir. Folks, you can find this podcast and more at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Until next time, all policies and procedures will remain in place.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.